From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. Young people should continue to get vaccinated for COVID-19. Despite the small number of cases of heart inflammation found in some people who've gotten it, the CDC expert panel who made that decision is also recommending the FDA provide guidance about this to doctors and parents. Dr. Henry Bernstein was on that panel. He's a pediatrician at Cohen Children's Medical Center in New York, and he joins us now with more detail. Hi, Dr. Bernstein. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Tanya.
Yes. So fill us in. What was discussed at this CDC panel meeting, and what were the conclusions?
We looked closely at the data that's available to date and really determined that the benefits of the vaccine far outweigh the risks of myocarditis or pericarditis, specifically because not only is it a rare event, but also it was mild and resolved with primarily supportive care.
I see. Were the conclusions unanimous among the panel?
So it wasn't a vote, but certainly the consensus was that the benefits far outweigh the risks, given all the data that we know. And we want teenagers and young adults to be vaccinated because there's a risk of heart disease associated with getting COVID-19.
But out of an abundance of caution, the panel is recommending that the FDA add a warning to the vaccines. Is it for physicians, or does it give parents specifics about symptoms to watch out for?
No, it'll be something that will appear both for the families, parents, as well as for providers. And so it will discuss recommendations. For example, if someone has had myocarditis or pericarditis prior to their COVID-19 vaccine, we recommend that they receive the COVID-19 vaccine. If someone's had pericarditis after the first dose of an mRNA COVID vaccine, but prior to the second dose, we feel that it's still okay to proceed with that second dose of the vaccine once the resolution of symptoms has occurred. Of course, the patient and family should discuss this with their clinical provider. That would include a pediatric cardiologist.
For parents who are listening to this, I'd love to give them a little bit more clarification. Let's break down the numbers just a bit. We're reading that there have been just over 320 confirmed cases of myocarditis in people under 30. 309 of them were briefly hospitalized, 295 already discharged. That's out of 50 million doses given out to that age group. But how serious is myocarditis in kids who get it? How treatable is it?
Well, fortunately, it is treatable. And fortunately, the myocarditis that we're seeing associated with the mRNA vaccine has been mild. So yes, the children have had some symptoms, some chest pain, perhaps shortness of breath or palpitations, but they've been able to manage it well, and it has resolved quickly without complications. The heart function returns to normal. That's not always the case when there's heart involvement associated with COVID-19 or myocarditis associated with other viruses.
Before I let you go, you touched on this. There is a risk of getting myocarditis from actually catching COVID-19. Those numbers are higher than the ones you're seeing from the vaccine?
Yeah. If a million children, males, 12 to 17, were to receive the second dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, the predicted cases prevented would be 5,700 cases prevented, 215 hospitalizations prevented, 2 deaths prevented, and there would still be 56 to 69 myocarditis cases. But again, generally they're mild and self-resolving with supportive care.
That's Dr. Henry Bernstein. He's a pediatrician at Cohen Children's Medical Center in New York and a member of the CDC's expert panel that issued new guidance on coronavirus vaccine for teens. They say it is safe to get them. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Now to Colorado, where some students are trying to improve access to health care at Denver Public Schools. They're rewriting standard medical consent forms to make them easier to understand for parents who might not have a college degree or speak English. Colorado Public Radio's John Daly explains.
It's a reunion a year in the making.
Hi,
guys.
Hi,
baby. We missed you.
How are you?
It's massed hugs all around by the red and blue arch of Denver's Manuel High School. With the city's skyline as a backdrop, teacher Whitney Weathers greets a group of students she hasn't seen, at least in person.
When did we close down the school?
For 14 months, since March of 2020. The meeting is also a celebration of sorts, says senior Serenity Sudabom.
Honestly, it's super surreal. When we first started off this project, we didn't think that we were going to be making this much of an impact.
The impact came from the students' efforts to rewrite and simplify the health access forms used by thousands of Denver Public School students each year. The spark began with a technical writing class, English 131, and a realization by Weathers as she was teaching.
I started realizing that technical writing, although it's supposed to be colorblind, right, the singular writing profession is supposed to be colorless, it is actually the one that impacts all people of color, right?
She thought that was pretty relevant at Manuel High School, my alma mater and home to one of the state's most diverse student populations. Weathers describes herself as an introvert, but she's a tenacious one, and she thought one specific piece of technical writing deserved attention.
Everyone has to experience at some point signing a consent form.
A consent form, like the one parents use so their kids can gain access to medical care and health clinics based at 18 of the Denver system schools.
All the writing was extremely small and it was so long.
None of it matched what we were learning were the standards for what makes something readable and understandable.
That was Serenity Sudabong again and sophomore Morgan Pulling. The students found that the forms in English and Spanish were written for college-level readers. They were often vague and filled with challenging medical terms and legalese, says another senior, Victoria Torres.
The people using this clinic are low-income people of color, marginalized groups, and they expect them to read at a college level when they probably didn't even graduate high school.
So these high school students, some of whom are part of a medical internship program, methodically dug into the forms. They examined visual appeal, vocabulary, sentence length, number of words, and font size. They searched for relevant academic studies. They consulted with consent form guides and...
So as you know, my name is Morgan Pulling.
...prepared a PowerPoint presentation which they gave over Zoom to the folks from Denver Health who operate the clinics in collaboration with Denver Public Schools.
Only the well-educated can properly read and comprehend most important medical consent documents, which is unjust.
The health professionals listened.
Thank you guys so much. I don't know if I'm a button in front of anybody, but this is Lucy. You guys did an amazing job.
And offered feedback.
And this is something that I work with on a daily basis, so I really appreciate having your thoughts on this.
And in the end, the medical leaders running the clinics concluded, hey, these students are right, says Denver Health Youth Program Coordinator Tara Milinkovich.
They were amazing and insightful and brought such real experience to a form that I don't think we give a lot of thought to.
Milinkovich concedes the consent forms are often confusing, too long, and hard to read. And she says they were creating a barrier to healthcare, which is the opposite of what the clinics want.
So it's a big deal. And those students had a big impact.
A big impact because based on the efforts of the students, Denver Health changed the forms. The new ones are better formatted with bigger font. Student Morgan Pulling says key medical information is now much more clear. Take, for example, medications.
In the first form, the only reference to medication is nonspecific, so there's no specification on what medication students can actually receive.
On the new forms,
all of the medications with the brand and generic names are listed.
And on the new version is a checklist.
You can either approve all medications, decline all medications, or choose exactly what medications you want your child to receive.
It's not an exhaustive list of the medications provided in the clinics, But now parents can choose if they'd like their child to receive certain over-the-counter medications administered by a school nurse.
I mean, it's just a whole lot more clear, and it gives parents much, much more control over their child's safety.
Not a bad accomplishment, says senior Victoria Torres.
So yeah, it's a good thing out of, you know, a hard year.
And one that made intrepid teacher Whitney Weathers proud.
I think they made lemonade out of lemons. Quite tasty, too, if I just might say so myself.
Now at Denver Public School-Based Clinics, it'll be entirely new forms and ideally better health care for some 12,000 students. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly.
Sporting events, festivals, and concerts are back. The Foo Fighters, for instance, played the first full-capacity show since March of 2020 on Sunday at Madison Square Garden, and their hit Times Like These really hit home with the crowd.
It's times like these you learn to live again.
So many of us are eager to live again, to catch a live show or sporting event that forecasters believe attendance numbers of large events could meet or surpass levels seen in 2019. Ronnie Mola is a senior data reporter at Recode, and she's been writing about this. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes, thank you for being here. So we knew it could take some time for large events to return into full swing. But now that vaccines are widely available and more states have opened up, it appears events are already to a good start. What are you hearing about how the industry is doing overall right now?
Yeah, it's definitely happening more quickly than people had expected. You know, even a couple of months ago, a lot of these ticket platforms were surprised that, you know, events are coming back in the way that they are. We have estimates that say, you know, what event attendance is going to be like in this year compared to what it was in 2019, you know, which is a good year to compare to. You know, 2020 was sort of a lost year. And while the estimated attendance levels aren't quite at 100%, they're getting there, and they're getting there for certain types of events and in certain places.
Well, you actually spoke with Campbell Brown, who is CEO and co-founder of the demand forecast company Predict HQ. And he said that a recent sporting event in Texas really illustrates current demand for large events. Let's listen.
So even when you look at the Canelo versus Saunders boxing event, that attended event, full capacity, was the biggest attended boxing event in U.S. history. And that happened a month ago. That was 73,126 fans.
That is really remarkable. 73,000 people at an indoor boxing event. Ronnie, what other kinds of events are people in the mood to attend?
Yeah, you see these record attendance for a number of different, like, big name concerts and festivals. You have things like Bonnaroo and Austin City Limits. You also have big names like Billie Eilish and Bad Bunny. You know, part of the issue is that there just aren't as many events scheduled as there used to be, you know, back in 2019. But as events companies are seeing the demand, and sometimes this really great demand, you know, things selling out in a matter of minutes for the existing shows, they're adding more to their lineup for the rest of the year.
Well, of course, this is good news for those venues. It also is good news for local economies, right? In the months ahead, because they benefit from all of those folks gathering in one place.
Yeah, one of the estimates I got from Predict HQ was saying the sort of collateral spending, you know, what people spend on hotels and air travel and food when they come to these big events, you know, is something like $1.6 billion in June. And the last time it was over $1 billion was, you know, February of 2020. So not only does this benefit the events themselves and the people putting it on, but also the larger economy in these areas.
And the folks that you spoke with for your reporting, did they talk about the concern or fear of these places becoming super spreader events?
Yeah, I was surprised that it sort of seemed like less of a concern. You know, people feel that it's under control, you know, even if they have to rely on these apps that say, hey, I'm vaccinated. You know, whatever precautions are in place seem to be enough for people. You know, that said, there are people who are never going to go to these events again, who are, you know, completely scared off. So that's sort of going to go hand in hand with the vaccine program and how successful it is and how, like, and how caseloads are doing.
What will you be watching for regarding this in the coming months?
So I think one thing to keep an eye on, obviously, is just vaccine rollout, that people continue to get vaccinated, that there, you know, isn't a surge in cases. A lot of this has been trending along with the success of the vaccine program. Also, just the number of events that keep getting booked. You know, if these events keep selling out in record time, you know, more events companies will put on more events and, you know, there'll be more things for people to attend. The thing that experts kept pointing to again and again was this idea of pent-up demand. Was, you know, we spent a year inside not going to anything, especially not anything where we'd be with a lot of other people. So there's just this like desire to get out there and do the things that we used to do. So that's what they're banking on.
Ronnie Mola is senior data reporter at Recode. As always, thank you so much, Ronnie.
Thank you, Tanya.
This month, NPR is reflecting on the 50th anniversary of the war on drugs. And in this encore story, TV critic Eric Deggans looks back at how decades of scripted TV dramas have informed and misinformed our perceptions of that war.
David Simon created two of TV's most groundbreaking depictions of the failure of the war on drugs, HBO's The Corner and The Wire. One classic scene from The Wire features a police lieutenant explaining how constant drug arrests in poor black neighborhoods have destroyed officers' connection to the community they're supposed to serve.
I mean, you call summer war, and pretty soon everybody's gonna be running around acting like warriors. They're gonna be running around on a damn crusade, storming corners, slapping on cuffs, racking a body count. And soon the neighborhood that you're supposed to be policing, that's just occupied territory.
But Simon calls himself a, quote, cockeyed pessimist about actually ending that war. He says cop shows are part of the problem.
I don't think we can win this narrative.
Simon says many of these shows are written and filmed from the perspective of law enforcement.
It's just too much fun for normative America, for the America that isn't vulnerable to these policies, to put the cameras next to the cops and venture in like it's our modern day Western.
America's war on drugs was officially declared in June 1971 by President Nixon, who called drug abuse public enemy number one. Polls show the American public now mostly sees the war on drugs as a failure, and experts like Johanna Blakely, managing director of the Norman Lear Center, say the messaging in fictional TV series can be more influential than facts in news reports.
Entertainment is probably much more effective in terms of changing people's values and attitudes and beliefs and behavior even, than news programming is. It kind of gets under that radar.
Early police dramas like Dragnet set the example.
The story you are about to see is true.
Dragnet, on the air in the 1950s and 60s, lionized straight-arrow police detectives who lectured young people over how a hit of marijuana could lead to a raging heroin habit. Here's Joe Friday, played by Jack Webb.
I know that, in fact, too many kids that begin with pot end up with heroin, then on to LSD. The minute they drop one acid capsule or ingest it in any way, they bought the farm. They've lost any chance to depend on and even restore that most precious of all inner senses, judgment.
But it wasn't until NBC unveiled a little TV show called Miami Vice in 1984 that the war on drugs on TV got a serious makeover. It was an iconic hit based on flashy undercover cops, with hunky stars Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas, MTV fast editing, and a throbbing theme song from Jan Hammer. Oscar-nominated director Michael Mann was the executive producer of Miami Vice. He says the energy of South Florida was its secret sauce.
South Florida was magic. It was really Casablanca. It was also the northern banking capital for the whole of the South American drug trade. And it was just this gorgeous Caribbean twilight zone in which anything seemed possible.
Mann says the show's premise was inspired by laws allowing police to use any assets seized in drug arrests. Storylines sometimes came from shady characters producers met while hanging out in Miami nightclubs. But culture critic Nelson George says the glamour of Miami Vice also united America's gangster obsession with its Law and Order obsession.
What's interesting about Miami Vice is that Michael Mann understood, but to give them the veneer of the drug dealer, to give them the clothes and the cars, now that's sexy.
1 year before Miami Vice went off the air, a 1989 Gallup poll showed Americans had a record level of concern over drug abuse, fueled by the crack epidemic and worries about drugs imported from Mexico. But fast forward 10 years, and new cable TV shows shifted the narrative to humanize drug users and dealers, including David Simon's The Wire. In 2002, FX debuted The Shield, an acclaimed series about a rogue, abusive cop. Creator Sean Ryan noticed as he was writing the show that public sentiment about drug users changed as people's idea of who was using drugs also changed.
I think it was easy for white America to have one point of view about the drug war when it was mostly hitting minority communities. What really changed was the opioid epidemic that began to affect people across all races, and especially white people, and especially people in rural communities.
But viewers' ignorance about the racial inequities of the drug war may also have been inspired by TV. The Lear Center's Johanna Blakely says two different studies show popular police dramas often avoided depicting how people of color are disproportionately arrested and jailed on drug charges.
The animals, trap, 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 till the cages fall.
Netflix's Emmy-winning Orange is the New Black debuted in 2013. It was among several modern dramas presenting a more critical and inclusive vision of the criminal justice system. But cultural critic Nelson George says there are some realities TV still struggles to face.
Americans are junkies. You name it, Americans got to get high. And that's the reality that America does not want to face.
After more than five decades depicting the war on drugs, seems the TV industry still has a few things to learn and more stories to tell. I'm Eric Deggans.
Capitalism touches every part of our lives.
Capitalism is a giant force that I don't understand.
I feel that it's a very safe system.
I'm constantly in fear of losing my job.
It is our biggest success and our biggest failure.
On this special series from Throughline, Capitalism.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
A dramatic search and rescue effort is underway in South Florida. A 12-story oceanfront condo partially collapsed early this morning in Surfside, a beach community just north of Miami. At least one person has died. Many others are still missing. Ray Jadala of Miami-Dade Fire and Rescue spoke with reporters earlier today.
We do have our heavy rescue. We have our heavy equipment, such as our Paratex. We are shoring up the structure on the inside as we continue to tunnel in to locate additional survivors.
Our reporter Samantha Gross has been at the scene this morning for the Miami Herald. Samantha, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
This happened in the middle of the night when people were asleep in their beds. At this point, what else do we know?
Yeah, as you said, you know, the building, the Champlain Towers South condo, it's only one tower of a multi-tower building, came down around 1:30 in the morning. So people were, you know, asleep in their beds inside. Right now, you know, they're still looking for people in the rubble. There's kind of a full search and rescue mission going on with dogs and with, you know, devices that can sense movement, even like the tiniest movements of scratching or voices and breathing. To try and tunnel into the rubble and find folks who might have been left behind. There's also kind of a large family reunification effort going on just up the street at the Surfside Community Center, where relatives and friends and family are trying to, you know, locate their loved ones who lived in the tower and who may, yeah, you know, they might have a hard time getting in touch with.
I saw a video of a boy this morning getting pulled alive out of the rubble, slung over a firefighter's shoulder. Do we know anything else about him or if any other survivors have been found?
Yeah, we don't know much about the boy. You know, that's a video that we've published at the Miami Herald as well. And they are, you know, still looking for people. It seems like the, you know, big rescue was kind of in the middle of the night. And there's still a long list of missing people that they're trying to find. You know, from at the scene, we talked to some survivors who said that they were rescued from their balconies. You know, a lot of people woke up in the morning to find that the stairwells had kind of been warped and they couldn't get out of the door. Things like that, you know, seeing rubble and dust in their hallways and trying to, you know, yell and scream for help. And, you know, I think they said about 35 people were taken from the building. 10 people were treated at the scene, 2 hospitalized. Those numbers are expected to rise.
Yeah. A lot of questions are still going to be unanswered because it just happened a few hours ago. But tell us more about the building itself and if there are any theories about why it might have collapsed.
Yeah. I mean, right now, obviously, there's a lot of question marks here as to what had happened. You know, this is a building that was just about to undergo, or I guess it was kind of in the process of undergoing its 40-year inspection. It's a building that was built in the 1980s. The people who live there kind of described it as a building that they never really felt, you know, nervous about. I spoke to a woman this morning who inspects homes for, you know, hurricane windows and doors. And she said that, you know, it's a reinforced concrete building that seemed.
We might have just lost Samantha there. That was Samantha Gross reporting for the Miami Herald, speaking with us about the condo that partially collapsed this morning in Surfside, Florida, outside of Miami. Many are still missing.
Sesame Street has a few new neighbors. The children's program introduced its first gay couple earlier this month in an episode called Family Day. And today the world meets two black Muppets who are taking on race and racism, 5-year-old Wes and his father Elijah.
Things on the outside, like our skin color, our hair texture, our noses, our mouths and eyes, make us who we are. Many people call this race. But even though we look different, we're all part of the human race.
That's the father, Elijah, explaining to Wes and Elmo the concept of race. It's part of a series called The ABCs of Racial Literacy. And with us to talk more about this is Rocio Galarza, vice president and the U.S. Social Impact Department at Sesame Street Workshop. And she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for being here. Well, we know Sesame Street, through its 52-year history, has taken on many societal issues. Over this calendar year, we've been confronted with the societal problem of racism. How did you come to this decision to use Muppets to take this on?
Well, we know that racism is a systemic issue. It's an issue that preschoolers are tackling because children begin to observe and internalize messages around race at a very young age. And for us, it was very important to have tools and resources to be able to tackle this in an explicit way. And so when we are looking at the potential resources, we always look at how can we represent and how can we deliver these messages in a way that children can understand, that is age appropriate. And part of it is looking at the characters that we have, and we had really wonderful characters already that were part of the Black community, Tamir and Gabrielle, but we were missing a 5-year-old. We were missing a young kid, and that's what we inspired us to create Wes. And of course, these issues are important not only for children, but for adults. They need to be guided by their caregivers. And so that's where Elijah came along, a father of this wonderful little boy. And it gave us an opportunity to not only look at the relationship that these two wonderful characters will have, but also how they enter into this community for Sesame Street.
Yes. Well, Father Elijah, as we heard in that clip, carries this conversation with his son. It's a modeling of how to have conversations about racism. It's the way that parents theoretically should talk to their children. This was intentional. You're modeling this here for parents who may be watching this with their children.
It is important because we know that children are not colorblind, and we know that they're very curious about the skin color, how they look. They want to talk about these things. And it is up to us, to us adults, to use language that is age appropriate to then explore it with them and to be as honest as we can, but still be very understanding that they are seeing it through kids' eyes. And so we need to have those talking points. And they're, you know, sometimes it's a little bit difficult in the moment to come up with a talking point. So for us, it's always important to model what an adult could say, just to give you ideas and to be able to start the conversation. Of course, you know, as parents, we know our children's best. So we don't expect to be the only resource that you use or to follow exactly what we say, but we do hope that it gives you a sense of what children at that age could understand and would like to know more about.
Well, how should we expect what's happening in our world to be translated to language on the show that the children can understand? I'm thinking about police shootings, for instance.
Well, we start with young kids talking about identity. Actually, funny enough, we don't start with the big topics all because it's an ongoing conversation. We cannot expect everything to be done all at once and all of these topics. We tackle everything. So we actually start with identity, with understanding identity and appreciating who we are, which is why that segment that you had with Wes and Elijah has been so powerful, because it is about understanding your skin color and having a simple explanation of what that is. But we also go deeper, right? Who we are is not skin deep. We have to be strong in our skin, but we have to know people beyond their skin color. The next stage will be really talking about fairness. What is that? And what are instances that are unfair? And that's what we are exploring in this push of content in Sesame Street and communities. We have the ABCs of Racial Literacy, which we launched in March as part of the Coming Together initiative. And we started to explore some of these concepts. Of course, it's an ongoing conversation, so we have to keep updating and providing more resources. But right now, we're talking a little bit more about those circumstances that children experience themselves that are not fair. And so Wes, someone made fun of his lunch and because it's curry chicken. And so Elijah is helping Wes with a strategy to cope with that racial related situation.
I actually want to play a clip of something that illustrates this. This clip features Evelyn. She's a young girl who gets bullied for the shape of her eyes. And she turns to Wes and Alan for help. Let's listen.
I was at the park today, and the boy told me I was ugly. He made fun of my eyes. He said they look slanty.
Oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. That child was wrong to say those things to you. Your eyes are the perfect eyes for you. Yeah. Just like my eyes are the perfect ones for me.
And what is part of the magic of Sesame Street is that it often takes on these complex topics by partnering a human, like Evelyn in this clip that we hear, with a Muppet to explain complicated topics. This is exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, and I think that what that segment does so well is taking a moment that is very hurtful and turning it into a learning moment, and understand that there is a relationship in this particular case with their eyes and the family story, and how wonderful, right? That is the main takeaway from a moment that was so hurtful to her. And so having a simple strategy that at least connects their feelings to the situation and also lets them know that they can reach out for help for an adult is very important to have beforehand. And hopefully we can prevent some of these situations from happening.
Rocio Galarza is the vice president of the U.S. Social Impact Department at Sesame Street Workshop, talking about the introduction of two new Black Muppets, father and son, Elijah and Wes. Thank you so much for speaking with us about this.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And visit our website, Sesame Street and Communities, to get the resources.
Okay, kids, keep listening.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Recently, we've been hearing graduation speeches from inspiring people around the country, and today we're making a stop at Hightower Elementary in Doraville, Georgia. At the fifth grade graduation, the speaker was a beloved member of the school.
I want to say congratulations to the fifth graders. You made it through elementary.
Tylen Bailey has worked at Hightower for 23 years as the head custodian, and he's also been hard at work at something else. Mr. Bailey just received his teaching degree from Georgia State University. In his speech to the graduating fifth graders, he thanked the students for getting him to where he is now.
Right now, I want to say thank you to fifth graders. Whether you guys know or not, y'all helped me get to this point. Every day I came here, I looked at y'all, I said, you know what? I can teach kids like that. You guys are great kids, great students.
And like any good commencement speech, the teacher-to-be had some advice for the graduates.
Just remember, no matter where you are right now, as long as you work hard, you can be more. If it takes you a long time to get where you want to be, just remember, stay on your path. You can get there.
And Mr. Bailey should know his path will take him to Briar Vista Elementary School in Atlanta this fall. He'll be the new PE teacher. Congratulations to him and the graduates of Hightower. Would you eat vanilla made from a plastic bottle? It's an odd question, but you might have the choice someday because scientists at the University of Edinburgh have successfully converted plastic bottles into vanilla flavoring. It's the byproduct of feeding plastic to bacteria. Stephen Wallace is one of the chemists who helped conduct the research, and he joins us now from Scotland. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. Nice to meet you.
Well, it's nice to meet you, too. And at first glance, this sounds like a kind of wild idea. Where did it come from?
Yeah. So in essence, this study uses quite a new technology that's emerging at the moment that's called synthetic biology, where we can program microorganisms, very common, very safe microorganisms, to do new things. And one of the things that this has obviously been able to do is to provide a new solution to the global plastic waste crisis.
Okay, so how do you do it? How do you turn plastic into vanilla flavoring?
Yeah, great. So what we do initially is we depolymerize plastic using an enzyme that's called, it's a polymerase actually. And then we feed this to a bacterium that's programmed using synthetic biology. And it simply just eats the plastic waste and uses five different enzymes in the cell to convert the monomer of plastic, which is a molecule that's called terephthalic acid, into vanillin.
Hmm. Okay. This is synthetic vanilla, right? Of course, it's not natural.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, actually. Even though this has come from a biological organism, it's definitely classified as synthetic, or we classify it as biotechnological vanillin. It's very different from synthetic vanillin, which we consume from most of the sort of food products and cosmetic products that we use every day that contains vanilla flavoring or fragrances. And this is actually made petrochemically at the moment from a molecule that's called phenol, which comes from crude oil, which is effectively the same feedstock as we use to produce gasoline for our cars. So it is synthetic vanillin, but it comes from a biological organism and is not from fossil fuels.
Okay. Well, the next question then is, why? And if we convert a lot of plastic bottles into vanilla, what are we going to use all that vanilla for?
Yeah, that's a great question. Vanilla has, or vanillin, which is the molecule that we make here, has such a huge number of industrial applications. It's used across the food and cosmetics industries. It's used in pharmaceutical synthesis and formulations. It's used in lots of cleaning products to make them smell nice. And you know, it has at the moment a global demand that's in excess of 37,000 tons a year. And this is expected to almost double in the next, the next 5 years or so.
Okay, so it's not just for food. Sounds like there's a lot of applications outside of that. But have you been tempted to taste it?
Do you know, that's been the most common question we've had since publishing this work, actually. We haven't tasted it, no, but it was a really wonderful moment when we fed plastic waste to this modified bacterium for the first time, and you could smell the smell of vanillin coming from the laboratory. That was a really great moment.
Mm. So you know it's working. I'm sure many people are wondering if it is safe for human consumption. I mean, it does come from plastic, after all.
Yeah. It's definitely something that we're looking at in a lot of detail at the moment. So the sort of regulatory pathways to human consumption are quite complicated. However, our view on this at the moment is, you know, if petrochemical vanillin can be approved for human consumption, and this comes from, you know, fossil fuels and gasoline, etc., I don't see any reason why using a biotechnological process that's much greener, much sort of safer, I guess. I don't see any reason why that couldn't be approved as well.
Okay, so let's get into bigger picture here, which is that there's a lot of plastic out there in the world that just either ends up in landfills or in our oceans, unfortunately. What do you think the impact of a project like this could be? Could it actually put a dent in this problem?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing to think about because, you know, as you say, a lot of the current solutions that we have to the plastic waste crisis even sort of involve us either incinerating this waste where it just ends up as carbon dioxide in our atmosphere anyway and contributes to global climate change, or we bury this in landfill and arguably don't deal with the problem at all. The other option for us is just to simply recycle this plastic into other second and third generation plastics, and this results in a gradual decrease in the value of the material economically. What this study shows for the first time is that you can actually take plastic waste and through a process or a biotechnological process like this, you can actually increase its value and re-enter it into the economy to do better things. And I think that's really certainly changed the way that I think about plastic waste. It's not this sort of problematic end product that we need to deal with. It actually can be used as quite a valuable feedstock for our economy.
Stephen Wallace, associate professor at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. He was one of the researchers who helped convert plastic bottles into vanilla flavoring. Stephen, thank you very much for speaking with us. Very interesting.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.